disguising one's discomfort with racial reconsideration as an intellectual critique is still allowed. Not only is it allowed in these public debates, it's an effective strategy to curb movements for social change. It is also not new. A century ago, a similar right-wing outrage campaign was launched against the teaching of evolution in public schools. Oh, remember the 1925 Scopes monkey trial, which remains a touchstone of this era of conservatism? So we are bringing you Jim Crow then and now. We are upholding critical race theory, and anyone who does not is riddled with white supremacy. Indeed, the very act of learning history in a free and multi-ethnic society is inescapably fraught. Any accurate teaching of any country's history could make some of its citizens feel uncomfortable or even guilty about the past. To deny this necessary consequence of education is to quote W.E.B. Du Bois, to transform history into propaganda. Let's not mince words about these laws that have passed, about the repudiation of critical race theory. They are speech codes. They seek to change public education by banning the expression of ideas, even in this censorship. Even if this censorship is legal in the narrow context of public primary and secondary education, it is antithetical to educating students in the culture of America's free expression. It is bombast. It is racist. It seeks to perpetuate institutional racism. And I say this in response to anyone who repudiates critical race theory. Well, what are we doing this morning? We're doing the opposite. We're upholding critical race theory by bringing you this outstanding series, Jim Crow, Then and Now. And what you were just listening to moments ago is really episode 2 of a 4-part series, but we're actually saying a 5-part series because we want to bring it up to looking at, in the 5th part, the issue of restrictive covenants and redlining and controlling where people live, which means you control their services, you can control the controlling apparatus, the policing mechanisms, and so on, of a restive population fighting for equal rights and justice. So we wanted to bring you that 5th part of the series, Jim Crow, Then and Now. And you can get this. You can get this by calling 212-209-2950. That is 212-209-2950. A $125 commitment is what it takes. And you will be upholding critical race theory. And you will be really doing what we must, which is to uphold education and understand that education is one of the tools of the equalization and building for equal rights and justice. It absolutely is. At a time when we are moving to the new Jim Crow in the criminal justice arena, certainly in the voting arena, right? The voting suppression laws in Georgia and other Republican states, like smack of Jim Crow rearing its ugly head once again. The episode that you were just listening to explores the dramatic rise of a successful black middle class and the determination of white supremacists to destroy this fledgling black political power. And through the efforts of men and women like educator Charlotte Hawkins Brown, African Americans continued to move forward. Black artists created new genres of American music, and an intellectual elite personified by the pioneering W.E.B. Du Bois. Du Bois, a charter member of the newly founded NAACP, was the editor of its magazine, The Crisis. Well, that episode that you were listening to ends with the violence at home giving way to warfare abroad and thousands of Black Americans departing for World War I. Overall, Jim Crow then and now. It looks at how did Jim Crow begin as Reconstruction ended, African Americans' efforts to assert their constitutional rights began to be repressed at every turn, betraying the promises of emancipation. It is so important to understand this, to teach these things. This is a magnificent, magnificent series. It is an excellent series, a powerful and dramatic documentary on Black life under Jim Crow, which captures both its horrors and brutality and the power in graphic detail while maintaining a central focus on how African Americans endured and resisted and challenged the system and continue to do that today. Jim Crow, Then and Now, 212-209-2950.
That's 212-209-2950 is the number to call, and you can get that package. Jim Crow, Then and Now. It is now 6 minutes past 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Report. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Margaret Kimberly, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Coming up, the president of South Africa maintains that the recent riots that followed the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma were actually part of an insurrection against the state. And something seldom changes when the two parties switch places in the United States. President Joe Biden is just as hostile to China and Cuba as Donald Trump was. But first, Broward County College in South Florida recently hosted a discussion about the turmoil in Haiti, where the president was assassinated by a mercenary force from Colombia. All the participants in the Broward College talk were Haitian Americans. Among them, Professor Reginald Darbon, and author and activist Pascal Robert, who emphasizes that class is an important part of Haiti's historical dynamic.
For me, the most important thing that has to be understood in terms of the current context of what is going on in Haiti is that something that is very rarely really effectively explained has to be made clear in the conscious of those who are truly interested in what is best for Haiti and the Haitian people. Oftentimes we get a narrative of the Haitian Revolution that is simply a conquest or a battle against of the blacks beating all of the whites and slave plantation owners and the French. And very recently people began to realize that Haiti beat more than just the French, it was the British and the Spanish as well. But very rarely is there an explanation of the actual complexities of the internal class dynamics that not only had a role in the Haitian Revolution, but also had a role in shaping the what would become the Republic of Haiti afterwards. First of all, one of the things that's most important for me to always understand when speaking about Haiti is the proximity of Haiti's revolution to the early birth of the United States. When the Haitian Revolution started in 1791, George Washington was president of the United States. We also have to understand that there were three categories of blacks on the island before the revolution begins in 1791. We had what were called pejoratively the Bosal. These were Africans that were born in Africa that were brought to the island, which means that they were more rebellious, they were less attuned to French culture, and they were more familiar with their various African tribal religions and ritual and backgrounds. They made up to 65-70% of the blacks on the island before the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. Then you had the Creole blacks, who were blacks born on the island. These blacks were more attenuated to the French culture, to the French language. Some of them were free before the revolution, like Toussaint Louverture, who actually owned slaves. Some of them owned Bosal African slaves. And some of them were slaves, like Dessalines, up until the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. Then you had the biracial or mixed race blacks, what we in Haiti called the mulatto. I know that term is out of favor nowadays, but that's really the only way we explain them in the Haitian context. The mulatto Creoles were born on the island. They were mixed race between the French and the African. And at one point, they owned 25% of the African slaves on the island. So before the Haitian Revolution, when you have pre-revolutionary Haiti, Saint-Domingue, you have three categories of blacks, all of which are basically in contest with each other. The Creole blacks did not like the Creole mulattoes, because often the Creole mulattoes wanted to be white and chose to inure themselves closer to their white patriarchs in the French language. The Creole mulattoes did not like the Creole blacks because they thought they were better than them because they were black and they didn't have their class standing. And both the Creole blacks and the Creole mulattoes despised the Africans because they thought they were savages underneath them. And they basically literally oftentimes treated them as slaves or owned them as slaves. This class conflict plagues Haitian society to this day. And very few people are willing to be intellectually honest about that. The revolution begins with, as we know in Haiti, as in Haitian law, ceremony Bwakaima, which is a spiritual pact that the Haitian Haitian African slaves, some were Muslim, some were voodoo animists, do in August of 1791. And a week later, they start ravaging the plantations to the point where the French are in jeopardy of losing the island. Spain comes in, trains the high-ranking black Creoles to fight for Spain because Spain wants to take the island from France, and they are fighting as Spanish soldiers against the French. Because the French are afraid of losing the island, they come in and tell the blacks and the mulattoes, who are more culturally attenuated to the French, that we'll free you if you fight for France against the Spanish. So those same blacks now become generals and soldiers of the French army and kick out the Spanish. The Spanish are out. The blacks believe that they are now good because they're going to be treated as Frenchmen. Guess what? The British come in and try to kick, because they believe they can kick out the French and put the blacks back in shackles. The blacks fighting under France now kick out the British. They believe that now they're going to be on the top of the island because now they'll be respected as Frenchmen. Napoleon takes over control of France, and he says, put all these blacks in shackles, take off the epaulettes of all of them, and put them under our thumb, or genocide the whole country. They come in, Dessalines takes over as Toussaint Louverture is captured and taken to France, and with the might of bringing together the mulattoes, the Africans, and the Creole blacks at the Treaty of Acaya, they come together and they kick out Napoleon and save the United States from being conquered by Napoleon's army and basically create the Republic of Haiti. After Napoleon, who was assassinated because he wants to do land reform, dies in 1806 and is killed by mulatto Creoles and black Creoles because they want to keep their land share of the property, basically the Bosal are treated as indentured servants, almost in perpetuity in the north, and the Creole mulattoes and the Creole blacks go to war against each other, creating the Republic of the North, the Kingdom of the North and the Kingdom of the South. And everything that happens in Haiti from then on is a consequence of the assassination of Dessalines and the inability to empower those African peasants who did not get any wealth as a result of fighting in the revolution, who became the 70% of Haitians who are poor to this day. And until we address those class conflicts, which is where we now have an elite who are for people who are not even originally Haitian, they're mostly Syrians, Arabs, Lebanese, Europeans, German descendants, who control over 90% of the Haitian economy. They make up the Haitian oligarchy, who I personally believe had a significant role in Jovenel Moïse's assassination. They work in the pockets of the State Department, plotting coup d'etats, kidnappings, and so on and so forth. Unless we neutralize the Haitian oligarchy, nothing will ever change in Haiti. And unless we change and neutralize this class antagonism, nothing will ever change in Haiti.
Does the Haitian diaspora see things the same way when it comes to creating a great political order on the island? Last, is the problem more internal than external, structural or cultural? What is it truly?
But the larger impediment to Haitian political autonomy is the rather oppressive relationship it has with the international community, and particularly the United States. What you have to understand is that since the U.S. occupation of 1915 to 1934, when the U.S. basically came in and, you know, emptied Haiti's coffers for various intrigues, fear of competition with the Germans who were doing business with Haiti to protect U.S. interests in the Panama Canal, and also help siphon off the money that we were paying in repatriation to the French. From that period of time, from 1915 to 1934, every time after that, the United States basically had the green light decision and who would be Haiti's president. And if it was a president that did not fit the particular needs of the United States, he would be removed. Like President Estime in 1950, who was removed because he was thought to be a quote-unquote soft socialist because he wanted to increase the minimum wage. Like Aristide was removed because he was considered to be a quote-unquote soft socialist because he wanted to increase the minimum wage. So anytime we've had a president that actually the people found some benefit in, that tried to do a modicum of adjustment to benefit the supermajority of Haitians who come from that bocile African class that I discussed in my presentation, who are poor, the United States has stepped in to hit them with a coup that has been conspired with those same oligarchical elites, particularly the current manifestation of them, who wants to make sure that the majority of Haitians, who are basically poor people, are ground to dust. As far as the diaspora, the sad reality of the Haitian diaspora is that some of them can maintain the same class perspective. If they were Haitian middle class or petite bourgeois, they had that worldview when they come to America. Many of them supported the coup to take out Aristide. So unfortunately, the class position of who you are in the Haitian diaspora may also determine what your politics are vis-a-vis what you want to see in the Haitian vision. Yet sadly, because many of them live in the West and capitalist countries, they still want to replicate the capitalist development model of what's good for Haiti. Hotels, I want to go on the beach, I want to come to Haiti, even though I come from the peasant class, now that I'm middle class, I want to go there and have my restaurant, born servants that I don't pay, shine my shoes and do whatever. So unfortunately, the capitalist realism of the Western countries they live in wants them to go back to Haiti and replicate the same vile class hierarchy that's grounding the country to powder, because they've been more inured with that capitalist realism living in the West. So even that presents a contradiction and a problem for the development of the country. And these are complicated issues that some would say can only be solved with a Haitian Revolution 2.0. I wish I could be saying I'm not necessarily in disagreement with that. I actually am not, because these problems are long and they are definitely, definitely ingrained in the social fabric and cultural fabric of Haitian society.
That was author and activist Pascal Robert, speaking at Broward College in South Florida. The continuity of U.S. foreign policy, even as the Democrats and Republicans trade places in the White House, is quite amazing. Although Democrats portrayed President Donald Trump as representing everything they opposed, when Joe Biden took control of the Oval Office, he left Trump's moves against China and Cuba intact, virtually unchanged. That subject was explored by Sean Blackman of Sputnik Radio's By Any Means Necessary in an interview with Netfa Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace.
As we speak right now, Netfa, Democratic U.S. President Joseph Robinette Biden is giving a speech on voting rights here in the United States. I'm looking at some updates, and he said, quote, "Some things in America should be simple and straightforward. Perhaps the most important of those things, the most fundamental of those things, is the right to vote. The right to vote freely. The right to vote fairly. The right to have your vote counted. The democratic threshold is liberty. With it, anything is possible. Without it, nothing, nothing." Adding that this speaking of voting rights, is a test of our time. And this is coming, of course, as, you know, Republicans are trying to roll back voting rights really all across the country. We've mentioned on the show, Republicans very aware that the more access people have to voting, the worse that they tend to do. And this is also coming amongst news that Hervis Rogers, the man who was all over the news because he stood at the presidential election, was actually arrested because he voted while on parole. And in states like Texas, if you quote unquote knowingly vote while you're still serving a sentence or on parole, then that's considered a second degree felony, which is punishable with a minimum of 2 years in prison and a maximum. This is, you know, pretty ridiculous. I mean, the fact that he like literally went on national, really international news and said, yeah, I'm going to vote, I think would imply that, you know, he was not, you know, knowingly breaking any law. But what I really want to get to, Nefa, is the hypocrisy of the United States. Because not only does this country portray itself to the world as the paragon of democracy and such things, it is at this very moment encouraging counter-revolutionary protest in Cuba over the issue of human rights, similar to what we hear the United States say in Venezuela and Nicaragua and China and so on. And so, you know, it's that the United States government seems to be so concerned about democracy and human rights in countries where the governments aren't in line with that of Washington and where they want to carry out regime change. But something that's considered a fundamental democratic right here in the United States, like the right to vote. I mean, there was a whole civil rights movement. I mean, people were bloodied, battered and killed just over the right to vote. And yet here in the 21st century, this is still such an issue. And so I think what it shows, not only the hypocrisy of this government and its system, Nefa, but also the fact that in reality, liberal U.S. democracy is not as advanced as it thinks it is, right on the hill that all other nations should bask in the glow of.
No, I mean, everything you said is absolutely right and on point. There's so much to say about the hypocrisies and contradictions around the democracy in this country and how it's generally used. A lot of it is leveled at induced, or whatever you want to call it, imposed at the level of propaganda and misinformation about what democracy is. Because in this country, they reduce it to a vote, for one thing. It's reduced to a vote. It's not reduced to information. It's not shown in terms of how people should be able to also have the right to even vote on policy and not just for representatives. And it's also because you mentioned two things. One, you mentioned here in domestically how it manifests itself, and then also internationally, the contradictions and hypocrisy internationally. So domestically, it manifests itself through the fact that there is really basically what some refer to as a democratic fascism in this country. So it's the democracy for the bourgeoisie. Really, we all know, it's no secret that the candidates are chosen by the ruling class and the people with money. And then when it comes to being on the policies that are passed by the legislators, those who have money are the ones who do the lobbyists and grease the palms and hobnob with the policymakers. None of the policies are really emanate from the people or are really in our best interest, but they can dupe us to make us think that some of these things are. So right now you mentioned the battle between the Republicans and Democrats jockeying for power over this country, but at the same time there's some really horrendous things that go on in terms of disenfranchising people from the right. That's just the simple right to vote, not let alone the fact that we don't have the right to national referendum in this country. Some countries do. They have the right to national referendums. We're not just voting for people to represent us and make policy, but actually we're voting for the policies ourselves. People can vote for the policies ourselves. The U.S. people don't have that. But in Georgia recently. Now, this goes to a lot of what Biden was talking about and the moves by a lot of Republicans to disenfranchise people from the right to vote in many states. But one thing they didn't talk about just prior to this election is in Georgia, and mostly this was discovered by this organization, Black Vote Matters, Black Vote Matters, I think, Black Votes Matter, and was that, and also the journalist, gosh, I can't remember his name now, but
Greg Palast?
Yes. Exactly. And they discovered 175,000 people were scrubbed from the voting rolls in Georgia, right? You would think that would be national corporate media news, right? Mainstream news. But they're fighting to discover, and they don't even know why. I mean, it's just completely gone, right? So we're not even talking about some, you know, where they, we're not talking about an incident where people were just being disenfranchised, but they were just taken off the rolls so they could not even vote. Now, let's get back to the example that you gave about people who are being prosecuted for trying to vote because they have a criminal record or whatever. They're not supposed to be eligible to vote. Now, that's not, you know, let's get past the fact that whether it's legal or not for them to do so or whatever. Let's just get to the moral, reason, whatever, you know, the rationale for denying people the right to vote because they have a criminal record. I mean, what purpose does that actually serve except to make sure that a certain, a certain perspective or a certain interest aren't able to weigh in on the policies that affect this, you know, the country and the government. Now, in some countries, like, for example, if we were to take Cuba, they do have also rules, laws that take away people's right to vote if they're incarcerated. But those laws only, and I'm not arguing that this is right or wrong, because, you know, that's not the point. But for them, the laws only apply while the person's incarcerated. After they're released, all of those rights are reinstated, and then they can vote. Now, of course, we just need to also mention Cuba. Them talking about how Cuba's not this democracy, and they make this comparison of a democracy versus generally the idea is generally democracy versus authoritarian governments, right? When they say democracy, when you hear the ruling classes and the main corporate media mention democracy, when they utter democracy, they're generally talking about capitalist countries. That's what qualifies you as a free market also. And then they mixed in the whole thing about the vote. It's only about the vote for representatives, you know, and only representatives of the Republican or Democratic Party, because this country, I mean, the actual powers that be do everything they can to marginalize and sideline any other party that's not the Republican or Democratic Party. I mean, this bastion of democracy has done so much to even disenfranchise and like the Green Party, for example, and that's the main one, because I think it's the more formidable of the other parties that here, where they refer to this country as a two-party, it's a two-party state, right? And then some would say, well, it's really a one-party state with just two wings, you know. But there's supposedly other parties that are supposedly legally have the right to run in elections, but the two capitalist parties do everything they can to make sure that they're inconsequential to what happens, everything that they can, in spite of the fact that, you know, many people want to have third parties, and the reason why they, you know, a lot of people don't vote for them is just because they don't, you know, they think that their vote won't matter, et cetera, et cetera. Now, with the other countries, when we look at foreign policy, and that's just the kind of trying to scratch the surface here in the domestic, how it shows up domestically. And I always remember this quote from Imam Jamil Al-Amin, who's formerly H.R.A.P. Brown. He was at H.R.A.P. Brown when he said it. It's an old thing when he was being interviewed. And one of he goes in extensively about it, about this issue of voting and elections. But one quote that stands out, and I think a lot of people say it, is that if voting in this country could, you know, make a difference, could actually transform the country for justice, they would make it illegal. So that's what we mean also by the democratic fascism kind of thing. Because right now, this like this, I mean, you know, referring to the garrison state, the police are militarized, everything, you know, they fortify around the, you know, when people demonstrate for the uprisings for George Floyd, you're seeing militarized police with gear and body armor and, you know, And that's what happens when there's elections. They're all around, you know, in terms of the big rallies after the inauguration. They're all around. This is, so this is a really, you know, militarized country, but it's not seen as that. And so when people demonstrate against, when there are workers that want to assert their rights, the police there protect them and protect the capitalists and whatnot. So this is, you know, and it's become increasingly fascist, but it's not seen as so because of the propaganda, and the media does its job to make sure that people think that they have rights in this country and that other countries don't have those rights. So country like Cuba, which people do not know, and even Venezuela, mentioned a couple countries, let's say the main ones in this hemisphere that the United States is targeting, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, have democratic, they have systems that most people have no idea how they operate, but they're considered quote-unquote authoritarian. And because they get that labeling, a lot of people would even assume or think that they don't even have elections at all. Some people think, you think people, Cuba doesn't have elections, and then when they couldn't keep that, you know, thing on, when they couldn't really keep that mischaracterization on, then they say, well, their elections aren't fair because it's a one-party state, and, you know, and they're only one party, and you kind of just have, giving the impression you just have to vote for, you know, which is ridiculous, you just have to vote for this one candidate or something, like it's an exercise in futility or something like that. But it's just not, it's not how the system works. It's much different than what they're saying. And it's actually more democratic than the United States. I would prefer to say Cuba is. And even, you know, Venezuela, they have elections over, you know, several elections, and they, both countries have the right to national referendum where people can actually vote for policies that affect their lives directly. And so, you know, that's just a few of the things. So the other, and then one part, and I'll end with this because I don't want to, there's so much to cover with this issue about democracy in this country, is when we look at places like Colombia, Brazil, which is actually they're supporting a person who's widely unpopular in Bolsonaro, and is also up for corruption, you know, charges and all this kind of stuff. They're supporting this person. Haiti, they just installed someone. They installed the person before him, and he was ill. He wasn't even constitutionally, you know, able to, you know, he wasn't constitutionally had the right. Constitutionally, he didn't have the right to be the president, Jovenel Moise, who was just assassinated, and they supported him. Now they installed chose the next person, Joseph, I'm blanking on his name.
Lambert? Claude Joseph.
Claude Joseph.
Joseph. Yeah. And so they just decided, well, this is the person. After a few of them were fighting over who's going to take over after Moise was dead, they said, well, we're, you know, the United States and the OAS, and then they appointed the person. And so in other words, they just circumvent the democracies of peoples around the world and call any place that is able to muster some sense of self-determination and popular resistance and popular participatory democratic approaches in their country, and label them authoritarian and make sure we're ignorant. The populace in the United States is ignorant to know what is actually takes place in those countries or even the processes, because the labels are all that's important. People don't, you know, how the process works and what they are. We don't get that kind of information or education in this country.
Yeah, and, you know, real quick, you know, you reminded me of a quote by Julius Nyerere of Tanzania when he once said that the United States is also a one-party state, but with typical American extravagance, they have two of them. Jackie Lukman.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to point out, Netfa, that you would be proud that I have my PACA shirt on today. I just so happened, felt like wearing red and said, hey, I'm going to wear the new PACA shirt. And you are, you know, an organizer for Pan-African Community Action. And what you said about the way we don't understand in this country that we don't actually have a democracy, we don't vote on the policies that directly affect our lives. How do you see, you know, understanding that translating into community organizing, that, you know, the kind of stuff that PACA, you know, Pan-African Community Action, does, you know, involve itself in?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. Thanks for asking that. I mean, one thing that, on the level that people do have the right to vote on, like policies or in laws, is on the local level. In some states have a referendum, national referendum, but on the local level, most cities have some form of referendum. And then what's the other initiative, ballot initiative, that you can actually vote on if you know how the process works, so you're not having to depend or rely on some representative politician to implement, to pass or rescind something or something like that. You can actually organize to do it. And I think we have more power on the local levels anyway, even regardless of what the states can do. I think we need to actually are organizing. It's very essential that people be organized, that the mass of the people be organized in ways that include and are led by the most adversely impacted people, groups of people in society. And so we have to build organizations where the most adversely impacted are in the forefront, with that also includes mass political education, collective political education processes in our organizing, and then we need to actually find, educate ourselves and engage challenge the powers that be in our places with ballot initiatives, and not so much running candidates for office. And that's nothing wrong with doing that either. I would say that one of the things we should do, to also part of your question, is to get away from the what can actually be turned into cult of personality, or just the individual, the popular person kind of thing. And that our candidates, when we run, they should be people that are fortified and chosen and in among the ranks of the organized people. In other words, it shouldn't be just some personality that pops up and says on themselves and decides their vocation is to be a leader and a politician representing the people, and they want to run and then convince everybody to run and follow them. And we say, oh, that person sounds good, and they're charismatic and they're articulate or whatever, and they're backed by this and that, and we vote for them because they sound like they're saying. No, we want to be organizing ourselves and getting our experience in organizing, and in our organization, in our collective, the work that we do, we actually choose people among us, and then we have a platform that we all come together and devise, and it's not just something that somebody thinks up out of their head and then we say, oh, that sounds good, but we collectively devise a platform that person is bound and has committed to representing, the organization. And even when we do these kind of campaigns, I think the best thing in terms of trying to convince the rest of the people to support it with their vote is to not talk about this individual, because in this country, it's really like a celebrity contest. It's really, that's all it is when they have these campaigns. It's a celebrity contest. We want to get people away from that, get people into critical thinking, get people to know that when they're supporting, they're voting for a candidate, you're not just voting for a candidate, or you're really not voting for a candidate. You're voting for someone who is the spokesperson, not even, spokesperson is a better word than representative, but the spokesperson for an organization and a platform. So that, I think that's what we need to, put our organizing efforts into. I mean, it sounds a little bit more daunting, and that's why people kind of opt to get that leader. And so it's quicker. They think it's a quicker road to some type of redress and some type of, oh, we got this person. They sound good. Let's vote for them. And it's easier to just vote for that person as opposed to actually doing the harder work of joining an organization, rolling your sleeves up, politically getting involved in a political education with other people where we're learning together, and then finding out how we can strategically challenge the rulers and the state that supports them.
Nepa, we've been talking some on the show about the information warfare that the U.S. government is currently carrying out against Cuba, and something that it does, I think, as a pretty regular tactic of regime change. And a part of the false narrative, of really the myth making around Cuba that the United States always likes to portray, is that the Cuban people are under siege by the Cuban Communist Party, and has been for the 62 years since the triumph of the revolution, and making it seem as though this is something being forced on them, that there isn't sort of broad support for the government or for socialism and that this is something that, you know, they're just sort of subject to. And I mean, you're someone who's been in the Cuban solidarity movement for a long time. I think we've both been there in recent years. And it's just not true that the Cuban people don't support the revolution or the Cuban government. And it reminds me of things that I hear people say, you know, when they've been to Venezuela or when they've been to North Korea or when they've been to China. And people say, oh, well, you just saw what they, meaning the big, bad, repressive government, wanted you to see. But I mean, but just the level of choreography that would have to go into the kinds of, you know, more casual expressions of support for the revolution that you see in Cuba and in these countries. It just makes no sense. And all for apparently the benefit of the gaze of like Westerners or people from the United States. I mean, it just makes no sense. And so there's been an all out assault on the consciousness of the American people, I think, in general. You know, we often talk about how Americans are the most propagandized people on this earth. But a big part of trying to manufacture consent for regime change in Cuba or any other country has to be crafting this thing as though, you know, there's just this monstrous, bloodthirsty communist government that is, you know, causing suffering for its people out of, you know, no other reason than out of sheer villainy. You know what I mean? And, you know, just history and just the countless people who have gone and visited the country and seen for themselves just prove this to be not the case.
Yeah, it is really. And they have to, they pour it on when it comes to Cuba, because I think Cuba, maybe more than any other country that's trying to stand up against imperialism, has been doing a good job of, you know, engaging in the battle of ideas. And I think so they pour it on. It's just a longstanding enemy. It's one of the oldest revolutions. And I mean, it's the oldest socialist revolution in Latin America, right, in terms of actually achieving socialism and people's power. And what you said reminds me of, I mean, when people buy this latest stuff, because there's a heightened reporting on these unrest that's happening in Cuba right now, and that how they're trying to depict it. And it reminds me how people kind of have to, it requires the level of propaganda they wage against Cuba requires people to surrender like all their common sense. Because it wasn't just before the pandemic, when the beginning of this pandemic, there was a cruise ship, and I can't remember the country that it was on, that was, they couldn't dock somewhere. No country would let it dock somewhere because it was infected with, I think it was Italy, and they couldn't dock, and because they had infected people there, and it seemed like the virus was just kind of incubating on the ship. Right, Cuba allowed that ship to dock, and found a way to, you know, get all those people off the ship and treat them, and then get them back to their country. Right, and so this is not. I mean, common sense would, like, it should baffle you if there's a country that's going to do that, that they would turn around and just be repressing their own people. That doesn't really make any sense. And then to go back to what you mentioned, you know, having been to Cuba, the kind of things where people say, oh, you know, you only saw what they wanted you to see. Well, I mean, I have to admit that when I was there a few times, I've had the privilege or the fortune to experience May Day there at least twice, right? Twice, maybe more than that. No, more than that, maybe three times. Anyway, yeah, I admit that probably Cubans wanted me to see May Day, right? But it doesn't matter. I mean, there were millions of Cubans in the street, you know, supporting the revolution, very proud of Cuba, just millions, like numbers, just, you know, numbers that you just can't make up, right? We saw it with our own eyes. You don't see it here. You don't get to see how the Cubans celebrate May Day with the patriotism and the pride in there, and not just, you know, the revolution, you know, and marching and you know, just partying, and not, and then you have May Day in Havana, but then you have expressions in other places. You can't force people to do that, which I've heard kind of ridiculous things like that before. You force people, not that many people, right?
Yeah.
Not when you compare it to, you know, the children in Gaza who are throwing stones at tanks and rockets, you know, so you're going to get, you know, you just can't get people to surrender that kind of, if you're really being repressed. They're not going to comply with that, and that number, you can't get that. Plus, if you're there, you can also see that there's no, you know, there's no like militarized police you know, at gunpoint with these. I mean, they, you know, some of them, most of them were like these young children, the marshals to the march. They weren't even police, right? And so these are the kind of things that if you have an international, when you have these experiences, you can couple them and see why certain things just don't make sense. Now, right now, the other thing is that there are some people who are, you know, dissatisfied. Clearly, these demonstrations show that there's some people who have some issues with what's going on and they're protesting. We'd be hardcore to actually speak to them directly in an interview, any of them at length. We might get a different point of view. They might not be what they might be, you know, different ones say that they're out there for, might be a little bit more nuanced than I'm just against the Cuban government, right? You know, we hear them say that they, you know, have concerns because of the lack of access to the vaccines. And Cuba also has developed quite a number of vaccines, right? You know, I think it's at least five vaccines that deal with COVID. And they've been on, you know, they've had a kind of a spike in it, but no one talks about the harshness of the U.S. blockade, the extraterritorial measures that isolate Cuba and make it hard, or if not impossible, for Cuba to do trade and business and other interactions with not just the United States, other countries, international firm, other companies around the world. One of the major things about the blockade is it's also denying the access to syringes, which of course are necessary if you're going to vaccinate people, right? So they've been able to develop these vaccines, but they've not tightened the blockade, but they've, you know, allowed for Trump's tightening of the blockade to insist, or his reversal of the Obama era loosenings to continue. They haven't, I don't think they've loosened any one of them, right? And so they've exacted. So the people that get frustrated, that's what sanctions are designed to do, and the blockade is designed to do. It's to create frustrations on the ground so they can cause instability, so that they have a pretext to have regime change, or if they can just have it from within. And they support. We know that there's U.S. Policies through the National Endowment of Democracy and the U.S. Agency of International Development and these things that are supporting groups on the ground that they claim are quote-unquote independent, but they can't be independent if they're getting their financing and then their directives from the United States government. They're not independent. They just mean they're independent, you know, whatever. They don't – it's just a word they throw on them. So they're actually doing everything they can, not just Cuba, but they use – Cuba probably has the most intense of these policies, the most pervasive of these policies, but they do the same policy in terms of undermining and trying to co-opt their citizens and to paying citizens in Venezuela and Nicaragua and Iran and wherever they can get away with it. They do this in order to promote regime change, and then accompanying that is what you mentioned in terms of the propaganda. So they will create, for example, they're showing the demonstrations in Cuba right now. They show the demonstration, and then they also, you know, do the angle. Like, what did you, I can't remember how the orchestration or whatever you said, how they, you know, how they cover it. And they have an angle to make sure that it looks like the most, more as most people, as many people as they look, you know, as they can make it look like. But then they do not cover the other counter demonstrations of people that are happening, also of people supporting Cuba. Now, what repressions of government do we know where anyone, you know, where the people are, you know, protesting against their government in any kind of mass, is there also some counter demonstration? Like real, you know, the ruling class is in control, and that they have their, you know, arms from, you know, the Western countries, people with bullets and all that, and that the people are still inspired. Like, for example, in Colombia, right? They don't even report Colombia. I mean, people have been in an uprising in Colombia and both Haiti, as we already mentioned, but Colombia, and they've been intact. You know, the Colombian police, who they are actually bringing on in to quote-unquote in Haiti to quote-unquote investigate what happened there, right? The corrupt Colombian police, you know, that they're using, and they can't even investigate the corruption and the killings that have happened in Colombia. In Cuba, we don't hear about them, like, kidnapping people in the night. And you know, this is happening in these other countries, kidnapping people in the night and disappearing them, and the demonstrations are being sprayed with, you know, weapons, with, you know, guns. That's not happening in Cuba. right? So, of course, you have unrest. You will have incidents with the police because, I mean, that's just what happened. I mean, you can't, you know, they're going to want to take keep control. But at the same time, the type of repression that they support in other countries is not happening in the countries that get all this spotlight from the corporate media.
Definitely. And we have a caller on the line here, Comrade from D.C. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, this is Comrade from Washington, D.C. I just had a question for NEDPA Freeman. He, you know, there's a lot of people who are now raising up the question of, you know, China's not really socialist in like the light of Cuba's protest and people's supposed concern for the protesters. But people are now saying, well, you know, China is not socialist, and look at what happened with Tiananmen Square. You know, we need to be more nuanced about it. And, you know, I just think that it's none of anybody, if you're living in the United States, it's none of your business if people are protesting instead of other countries, whether they're socialist or capitalist or whatever. But it is people's business inside the United States to oppose U.S. imperialism, which is trying to destroy these economies, preventing people from fully accessing their health, their well-being, their education. And these are all countries that refuse to bow to the United States. So a lot of these people just end up being squarely in support of the United States as a consequence of trying to make these like, nuanced kind of distinctions. And, you know, going so far as to calling them, like, you know, state capitalists and whatnot. So I was just curious about Netflix Freeman's take on that.
Thanks a lot, Comrade. Really appreciate you calling in. Hope to hear from you again soon. I mean, yeah, we were actually talking about this earlier in the show, Nefa. I mean, unfortunately, far too many of us got more nuance than we got good sense. But your take on our caller here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the caller makes a great point. I think that also there's a low level of I don't want to sound dismissive of people, but I think there's a lot more political education that people need to have. I do think that if you're in the United States, the first position that we should have, as the caller said, is anti-imperialism. In other words, the United States just doesn't have any business trying to, you know, overthrow other countries and trying to dictate to other countries. And right now we're seeing in the media all this Chinese propaganda is saying propaganda against China, saying that the China is trying to interfere in U.S. elections and interfere in the U.S. in certain ways. What was the light? Are you seeing some kind of cyber activities, cyber attacks, and things like that, which they level against countries that they. But the United States has been in the business of doing all these. And the cyber attacks are relatively, I guess, a new phenomenon. But the United States have been in the business of trying to sabotage other countries, particularly even China and Russia, for a very long time. You know, that goes back. Now the question of whether China is really capitalist, and I mean that's not one. I think that what people are dealing with is the economic superiority. Can I use that word, of China in terms of its investments and its industries and whatnot? Now, socialism really is character, and I'm not an expert on Chinese economy, so I don't really. But socialism, by its very nature, by its definition, is a transition from capitalism. Right. And so it's not like that there. So a lot of times people conflate communism and socialism. And socialism basically means that there are state regulations, that the state has a say in how a planned economy. So they have a planned economy, and China has that. So, and that's actually why they can actually be very successful on a lot of other things, like, for example, getting this pandemic underway and developing vaccines and helping build infrastructure in other countries, or have investing in infrastructure in other countries. And of course, there's its own foreign policy objectives that it has. And I'm not trying to, say that they're doing these things out of the goodness of their own of heart or anything. But we know the politics doesn't have, feelings that way, right? So there's political, but it's not militarizing the world like the Western countries are, France and the United States, asserting a dominance or influence by militarization, coming right out of being formal colonizing, not formal, they're formal, not only formal colonizing entities, but presently and currently neo-colonizing entities, meaning wanting to hold on to the complete plunder and rape of the former colonies, whereas China's relationships are bilateral relationships. And that if people, you know, if the people and the fact, if in fact those relationships are tilted and more to the benefit of China, then we need to be looking at the leadership in those countries that is not negotiating on better deals or better, you know, relations for the benefit of their populace. So, like, for example, in Africa, we look at people talk about Africa and Chinese in Africa, and often they bring this up as a response to us talking about the United States in Africa with its AFRICOM. What about China? Well, I mean, one, with U.S. imperialism and its militarism is a lethal and fatal thing that we have to take a stand against. And China just doesn't have that kind of relationship or presence on the African continent. And if people, and if we want to have any kind of, if we're concerned about the relationship or the type of trade relations that China has with Africa, then we need to be concerned with comprador governments, you know, because that's really what that is. So they comprador governments, and any governments, they have the ability to negotiate or work whatever kind of relations they can with China, because China's not imposing them on them through gunboat diplomacy as the Western countries use. And so, anyway, I don't want to go on too long just in case there's any, but that's my initial things, is that, you know, China has a socialist economy because it's planned. Even though they might have private companies, that those exist in socialist countries.
That was Netfa Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace on Sputnik Radio's By Any Means Necessary with Sean Blackman and Jacqueline Lukman. When former South African President Jacob Zuma was arrested on corruption charges, thousands of his followers rioted and looted in two African provinces last week. President Cyril Ramaphosa claimed the disturbances amounted to an attempted insurrection against the state. To dig deeper into this story, Press TV spoke to Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Detroit-based Pan-African News Wire.
It's a very unfortunate situation that is going on. The former president, Jacob Zuma, has contributed immensely to the national liberation struggle in South Africa. Unfortunately, due to the factional differences within the African National Congress, the ruling party, there has been a lot of turmoil. Now, he refused to continue to participate in the so-called Zondo Commission that is looking into the issues of state capture and corruption in the Republic of South Africa. He got up and walked away from the commission when he was subpoenaed. He refused to return. So the Constitutional Court made a decision that he was in contempt and sentenced him to approximately a year and a half in jail. So unfortunately, this has happened. But the people who are supporting him, for example, Carl Nijhuis and others, who you know, we've had a lot of respect for over the years, this is no way to address the current political differences. For example, South Africa has the worst COVID-19 pandemic right now on the continent. The focus should be on mitigating the COVID-19 spread and not creating a situation where people who are already unemployed, impoverished, are taking out their anger and their desperation against the small business sectors in KwaZulu-Natal and other areas of South Africa.
So do you think that this is a combination of what you just stated, the harsh economic conditions that were there, and then it got worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic, and also whether the party or the power base of Jacob Zuma, the KwaZulu-Natal, which is said to be his power base, is, according to what's been cited, to have a long history of political violence, if that's true. The combination of the two maybe perhaps have led to what we're seeing now with deaths, injuries to have occurred as a result.
Yeah, well, the violence that occurred during the 1980s and early 1990s was engineered by the former apartheid regime using the so-called Inkatha Freedom Movement, to fight against the African National Congress. Zuma and his supporters should be well aware of this. And some of the same elements, we're sure, are fueling the conflict that's going on right now. If I was in a position to advise the former president and his supporters, they should, of course, try to resolve this situation within the legal system. They are the co-architects of the Constitutional Court, of the commission system in the Republic of South Africa, and they could not say on the one hand that